On this very special episode of the People Stack podcast, Rob and I interviewed Joe Meyer. He is an NLP, a natural language processing researcher at a company called Erudites. They are basically AI for HR, their SaaS company. And so both Rob and I, and Rob, for those of you who are not familiar, is my husband and my co-CEO here at the People Stack. We talked about lots of different things in this episode. So there's going to be so many different things that many of you are going to find useful and informative and fun. We dispelled some AI myths with Joe. We talked about faking good because a lot of the data that comes from AI and for natural language processing comes from humans. And so humans are biased and might fake good. And so how do we know that the data is actually useful? We talked about the fear and the excitement around AI. We talked a lot about the intersection of AI and IO psychology, industrial organizational psychology. That is my background. It also happens to be Joe's background as well. He has his master's degree in IO psychology and he's working on his PhD. And for those of you who know or don't know, my PhD is in IO psychology as well. For one brief portion of the program, Rob basically interviewed the two of us as IO psychology experts. We talked about careers. We talked about following your passion. Joe opened up about his career and some of the fun and interesting and scary things that happened in his career. We talked about a bunch of different applications for fun applications, but also potentially, again, scary applications in the nefarious side of AI in the workplace and in the rest of our world as well. So grab a beverage, get comfy, and enjoy our conversation with Joe Meyer. Welcome to the People Stack podcast, where I share insights on how to upgrade your career as a technical leader. I'm Jen Funk. I am a career coach and co-CEO of the People Stack, along with my husband, Rob Allen. If you'd like to find out more about what we do here at the People Stack, please check out our free training at training.thepeoplestack.com. You're going to learn the four strategic and mindset shifts that our clients have used to command 300, 400, 500K plus salaries as tech leaders while living lives of abundance, freedom, and joy. And now, without further ado, please enjoy today's episode. Hello, Joe. Welcome to the People Stack podcast. It's awesome to have you here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, we're super excited for a number of reasons, which will unfold throughout the conversation. But before we do that, we want to give you a chance, just if you could introduce yourself, let folks know what you're doing now, and just a teeny tiny bit about your career path and what led you there. And I'm sure we will unpack that even further. So yeah, what are you doing now? How'd you get there?
Sure. So right now, I'm a natural language processing researcher at a startup called Erudite that's currently based out of the Bay Area in California. I'm also an incoming instructor at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and I'll be teaching natural language processing there as well. And so a little bit about my career path. I started at a school called Allegheny College in the East, a very small private school, studied psychology, did some research there, kind of like behavioral neuroscience stuff and things of that nature, like pharmacology. And then kind of worked in clinical psychology, worked in assessments like depression, anxiety, IQ, kind of you name it. And then ended up finding about IO psychology. I guess at the time I was interested in business consulting. That was kind of the path that I saw at that point. And I guess the romanticized view of consulting was appealing to me, kind of like oh, it's problem solving. You go to a client that's abstract and unclear and you kind of figure things out. So yeah, I went to IO Psych grad school at Louisiana Tech in their PhD program and finished the coursework and joined a company called Modern Hire as an IO data science intern. So kind of an industrial organizational psychology data scientist hybrid because I became very interested in that at the end of grad school. And worked with a great team there, worked on some interesting stuff like semantic search and automated job analysis, and ended up learning Python underneath a great team. I worked with Isaac Thompson and Nick Koenig and several others like Farshad. It was a great team to learn under. And then from there, I became more interested in data science and kind of that hybrid in the people space, and ended up joining Meta or Facebook. I think they were kind of at the transition at that point, and worked in like a research and analytics data science subteam within their people analytics team, and focused on data science there as well. Then ended up coincidentally meeting the founder of Erudite. I had been interested in their company for a while. And actually found out about them doing market research because I thought I wanted to go on my own and start like kind of a data science people analytics hybrid company. And they were a very similar company in the space and I couldn't really find any others. And I had just saw that they were speaking in the Bay Area. So I ended up going and I kind of forced myself to introduce myself to Alejandro. And then that just kind of ended up happening. So yeah, that's kind of a little bit about my path. And then, yeah, like I said, I'm involved with UC Santa Cruz right now and kind of exploring other teaching opportunities with different ed tech companies and see how that plays out. But yeah, that's a little bit about my path. And yeah, happy to be here and happy to talk to you today.
That's awesome. Let's, before we dive in even more, because there's lots of strings to pull there and lots of layers to pull back, that's going to be super fun. Before we do that, let's define a few terms for our audience. I don't want to make any assumptions. So sure. Our audience is mostly technical leaders, folks who want to upgrade their careers, folks who want to live their dreams in tech. So let's start with IO psychology. I think that maybe a fair amount of our audience knows about it, but let's define what that is. It's my background as well. I think as a lot of our listeners know, I have my PhD in IO psychology from the University of Connecticut. Go Huskies. The first part of my career was as an academic there. So I'll turn it over to you, Joe. How would you define IO psychology?
Sure. So I guess we can start with the basics. It stands for industrial organizational psychology. So I guess people typically think, oh, you're counseling people or you're counseling people within organizations. So there's a lot of connotations there. It's a fairly small field, and I guess that's why that happens. But you kind of have, I guess, overall, it's, I guess, in one sentence, it's the scientific study of the workplace. So we're applying the scientific method, kind of quasi-experimentation to the workplace to optimize different things. And then kind of within that, there's a lot of diversity. You have like industrial psychology. So this is your assessment space. So if you've taken like a personality assessment when you're applying for a job, that's potentially created by an IO psychologist because there's a lot of work in things like psychometrics. So like kind of like math and stats applied to like assessments. So like questionnaires kind of, I guess is the common term. Then you have the organizational psychology side. So this is a little bit more abstract. You have things like surveys, but also like kind of like change, transformation, consulting and stuff like that. So that's kind of like the more business consulting side of things. So you have like worker happiness, well-being, things of that nature.
Yeah. I love it. It's the science of work and the people who do it. It's fascinating stuff. Of course we're biased, but so that's IO psychology. The other term I want to define is NLP. And we're not referring to neuro-linguistic programming here. There's NLP in a whole other different world. We're talking about natural language processing. So give us the skinny on what that is.
Yeah, absolutely. So you kind of have the overall field of artificial intelligence, which I'm sure we're going to dive into at some point. And then within that, you have different areas, one of them being natural language processing. So you're basically dealing with computers and language. So there's a lot of text in the world. There's a lot of text within organizations. You think about search. You think about social media. There's text everywhere. And you're able to basically enable computers to understand that text for different reasons, for example, prediction. So a basic example applied to psychology could be, let's say, schizophrenia. So in schizophrenia, you have sometimes one of the symptoms, I don't know if they call it the positive symptom or something like that. I'm kind of out of clinical and abnormal psych for a while now, but you have trouble with speech. So you could have like disorganized thought patterns and stuff like that. And that manifests within speech or text. Let's say we have a bunch of people producing that text. We have schizophrenic people and non-schizophrenic people. NLP is a way to kind of make predictions about that, because there should be a pattern in language to kind of differentiate that. So to kind of back up a little bit, you just have text, you have language, and you're having computers and different algorithms understand those. And there's a lot of different use cases that we interact with every day. For example, something like Siri, Alexa, if you have a Google Home, these are all applications of NLP. You actually have ChatGPT now, which is ultimately just an NLP technology. It's a model or a suite of NLP models that can help understand text and do things. So it's very interesting. Right now, it's a good time to be involved in it, and it's definitely influencing a lot of things in our society right now.
So in terms of like a mental model for this, would NLP be a form of AI? Is that how we would think of it?
Yeah, I would kind of view NLP as a form of AI. So if like you have an overall field of artificial intelligence, I would say NLP is like one subfield within there. And I guess in some cases, NLP wouldn't necessarily be within AI. You can have like really basic applications of NLP, like let's just say finding subwords within a word or finding parts of speech. That doesn't necessarily have to be a form of AI. It can be a set of rules that would be more popular, like let's say 10 to 20 years ago.
Got it. Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about what you do at, is it Erudite or Erudite, the name of the company?
Yeah, so I think it depends on kind of what country you're from, because I've basically heard all different forms of pronouncing it. We can run with Erudite because that's what I say, but I've heard all different forms.
Yeah, I was like, oh, is it? There's no E at the end, but that's fun. Yeah. It looks like Erudite. That's a good name for it.
Yeah.
The connotation in there.
Yeah.
So anyway, at Erudite, you are, it's AI for HR, right? So it's the idea is that it's for people leaders, and you are using, I'm assuming, NLP and perhaps other forms of AI to gather information in order to make employees happier, increase employee engagement, increase retention. So would that be a fair assessment, a fair description of what it is that you all do at Erudite?
Yeah. I think that was pretty spot on. Kind of like a high level overview is that you have a lot of traditional survey vendors, and I'm sure as you've experienced when you're running like an org-wide survey, you know, data collection happens over, let's say, 2 weeks to a month. There's a bunch of reminders and stuff like that. And then you have sometimes poor response rates based on the culture of the organization. And then, you know, you're kind of scrambling to do the analytics. You're maybe designing your study as you're collecting data, or there's a lot of unexpected things that happen. So long story short, it can take weeks to months or even a year to disseminate information. For example, when I was working, there was like a consulting firm within my PhD program. And this one project, we were working with data that was probably over a year old from a survey. And I don't know if that's too crazy to expect. So getting back to Erudite, the idea is that surveys are tough. They take time. They're potentially biased. There's poor response rates. But can we kind of passively collect somewhat equivalent information without the time wasted of taking a survey. So if you think about things like burnout, which is of course predictive of a lot of things within organizations, or turnover risk, or how engaged employees are, we're able to kind of replicate that information without actually taking a survey. So it's kind of like an instant pulse of the organization. And we're relying on like different AI techniques to be able to do that. So at the end of the day, it's kind of designed to augment the employee experience without kind of having the burden of surveys.
Interesting. So would you be willing, or can you give us a specific example? I think burnout is a great example. That's something that we talk a lot about at the People Stack. It's something that we help our clients with to turn that around, to switch from being burnt out to being in flow, and to being more engaged. I'm not as plugged into the IO community. I did surveys. Yes, it takes months, sometimes years to get the results. So how might you use NLP and AI to predict whether someone, or if you were to look at it at the group level, if burnout might be simmering beneath the surface?
Sure. So I can dive into that a bit and try to, you know, skate the line of IP and not try to go too deep into the tech. But basically, if you think about something like burnout and language, there should be some kind of coherent pattern of burnout or signal of burnout within language. So if you kind of think about like defining burnout, we don't have to, you know, dive into an official, you know, operational definition. But it's stress. Okay, let's simplify it. When someone's stressed, how do they emit language? Hypothetically, theoretically, it's different from how someone that's calm is emitting language. So that becomes that signal within text. And you're able to train a natural language processing model to pick up on that. And once you train that model, you can use it to make predictions. So if you think about something like cross-validation within psych, right? You have a sample, you kind of fit a model to that sample, and then you have a holdout sample and you want to make predictions. The idea is that if you have a solid model within that original sample and you show that it generalizes well, you can use it to make predictions over and over again. You don't have fatigue like a human would. So you're able to use that model to make predictions on whatever variable you're interested in. So for example, you can make, let's say, 1,000 predictions within minutes or hours, depending on how large your model is. And then from there, you can kind of aggregate to the group level that you were talking about. So that's kind of like a overview of how AI and NLP applies to something like burnout.
Interesting. And so where does the data for this come from? Would it be like from emails, Slack messages, stuff like that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think there's a lot of different applications. Erudite specifically focuses on different communication platforms. So like Slack or Teams, email, things like that. But there's also applications to survey-based information as well. And ultimately, you can kind of think of this as anywhere text is being produced and anywhere you would think a signal is there, you could have some kind of application of NLP.
That's cool. Awesome. So let's see, Rob, where do you want to go from here? What's on your mind?
Oh, so many different things. So thank you for those intros, Joe. So when I hear about data gathering and data gathering in an organization, and then also trying to do different types of analysis on it, I wonder about sample size, and I wonder about like different. Most organizations I've been in have been wonderfully diverse. I know that's not true everywhere, but folks from different cultures, from, you know, where English is not just a second language, it's like an eighth language for some folks. How many of those folks need to be in the sample data for them to be accurately reflected in the burnout or whatever other things that we're looking for? Say you've got someone who is of a European descent, or, you know, some other language is their home.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think there's a lot there. I think one benefit of current AI and NLP technologies is that you have something called transfer learning. So basically you have a lot of the work being done ahead of time before you adapt your own model to it. So if you have something like GPT, or you have something like BERT that used to be involved with Google Search or T5 or something like that, these are all different NLP models. If you're not familiar with it, you have something called transfer learning, like I mentioned. So basically you have a huge amount of information. It used to be like terabytes. Now I'm not even sure what it's measured in, but you almost have the entire scale of like human knowledge in some cases that is used to first train a model. So I haven't read like the technical reports for something like GPT-4, but essentially you have like the entire internet or a curated version of the entire internet. You have a massive amount of books produced by humans. You have textbooks, all these different forms of text. And then now you have things like all of the video and audio content produced. So consider like YouTube as a source of information. And they're able to do something called self-supervised learning on it. So it's actually pretty simple. The idea is that, hey, let's take basically the entire internet, and of course I'm simplifying here, and let's predict the next word. And that ends up being really beneficial for a lot of different things. And how this connects to language and how much data you need. The idea is that because you're already gathering this massive amount of information, they're basically saying, hey, we now have a model that can do this. And we've tested it on many different things. For example, it can pass the bar or something. It can take the MCAT. It can take multiple choice exams. It can write poems, et cetera, which is like this crazy generalization just based on predicting the next word. Of course, there's more to it, especially with ChatGPT. But the idea is that once you kind of have that asset, you need very minimal data to kind of specialize it to something. So if you think about the entire internet of worth of information, you're of course going to have a very diverse set of representation of different demographics, for example, European or just across the entire world, right? So once you have that kind of solid understanding, you can kind of apply that with limited data to be able to generalize well. But of course, if you're applying that, you need to test it. So if you have, let's say, a language that you're not used to, you're going to need to find a specific model that you are using that can handle multiple languages, or it specializes within that language, and then you're going to want to perform, you know, some kind of experimentation to see that you're generalizing well to that population. Long story short,
yeah. If you want to use that among engineers, though, it's going to have to speak memes and GIFs and other non-verbal but text-based forms of communication, which is going to be a lot of fun for you guys, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, engineering culture with memes is probably one of the funniest things I've ever seen. I've enjoyed it a lot.
It's part of what keeps me happy and engaged in it. So when you were introducing yourself and you were talking about the different steps that you took to get to the organization that you're at right now, one of the phrases that you used, and we hear this a lot in our work, especially when we're talking to people who are really in a dream scenario of like the stars aligned and I have a role that I couldn't have told you existed before, but here it is. And you use the phrase, it just kind of happened.
Yeah.
Now, prior to it just kind of happening and you getting the wonderful conversation with, I believe it was Alejandro at that point, how many different meetups, how many different groups, how many different organizations were you actively participating in order to facilitate that final conversation that got you into this role?
Yeah, it was absolutely a ton of groundwork. I think when I was in grad school, like anytime I saw a meetup that seemed remotely interesting or there was someone that I had read research papers on, I would attend the meetup. At one point I was trying to gather just basically every source of information I could on NLP and also how NLP applies to psychology. So one example was he's currently at Virginia Tech as an assistant professor, I think, and before he was at Purdue and UPenn. But Dr. Lewis Hickman had been putting out research, and he was sort of in the same boat. He had a lot more experience. He was in grad school, kind of finishing up his PhD, but I saw the papers that he was putting out, and I just sent him like a cold email, like, hey, your work is really interesting. Can I learn more? And we just started having conversations from there. And I just kind of tried to do that with a lot of different people. For example, one of his current colleagues, Ivan Hernandez at Virginia Tech too, another great person in the space that is just incredibly intelligent, charismatic. So I'm just like, hey, can we just talk? And I would just prepare questions or just go into it with a learning mindset and kind of like, hey, I don't want to talk about myself. Like, I just want to ask you everything that I possibly can. And then just go from there. So it was a lot of just like networking, meetups and stuff like that to kind of just gather information. And then that kind of transitioned into like a lot of just time on my own. So I at the beginning, I spent countless hours just trying to learn how to program and trying to learn about AI, NLP, machine learning. So just diving into textbooks in my free time, like, you know, it's, I guess I probably have to thank my family for like putting up with it, but like, you know, like just trying to solve something at like a midnight or not being able to sleep because I want to read something that sounds like really interesting right now. So that was definitely part of it as well. Just kind of following what I was interested in. And then that kind of ended up influencing the path that was interest and passion.
Love it.
Wonderful. Yeah.
Love it. I love that you asked that, Rob, because this is exactly what we're wanting to point out more with career paths and your story, Joe, and how you landed where you are is a perfect example of it, is that it actually, we often say, and everybody says this, oh, it just kind of happened. I don't know. It just kind of landed in my lap, right? And so there is that element of synchronicity and serendipity that's involved in it. But also it's like inviting everyone to own their intention and to be even more intentional, right? Whether it's around talking with people and, or like you said, following your passion, following your bliss, following your joy. And often like people do that early career and then they forget later career. And what we're here to say is that it works all throughout your career, right? It's like, keep following that passion, keep following what it is that interests you, have those conversations. And yeah, I love that. I love how you landed somewhere that was unexpected, but still perfect for you. Yeah. So
yeah.
Great.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I guess synchronicity and coincidence is part of it. Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's part of it, but so is following your passion wherever it may lead.
Yeah. Yeah. I think of it kind of like, sort of like a cannon, maybe, if that's an analogy or a simile, if you would call it a simile, but like you kind of set a trajectory by kind of emitting whatever you're trying to do, whether it's focus or passion or something like that. And then once you're kind of with that trajectory, something ends up happening.
Yes.
Yeah.
The Inigo Montoya principle of networking and career advancement, you need to have the polite greeting, how you're related, what you want to have happen, and set expectations. Hello, my name is Inigo Montoya. You killed my father. Prepare to die.
That's how we teach networking.
Yeah, that's a good one.
It's very powerful. All right. So let's talk a little bit about AI and dispelling AI myths, because I know that's one of the things that we wanted to talk about. What would you say are some of the biggest AI myths that are out there? That are out there right now.
Yeah. I would say one of the biggest ones, like if you think about like the, I guess like stereotypes or connotations of what people think AI is, potentially a little bit off base from what actually is going on. So I feel like a lot of people automatically think robots. They think humanoid robots or like robots with no like sentience. I feel like that's a little bit off. The future of artificial intelligence is probably heading there, different forms of it. But the current form is, I would say, more different than that. Of course, there's different fields that delve into like the humanoid aspect of things and also the robotic aspect of things. And there's many different applications there. But for the most part, and at least what I focus on, you're dealing with more narrow forms of artificial intelligence. So you're not really dealing with like an omnipotent being that's basically a human and you can't tell the difference between a human and silicone. So at this point, we're mainly dealing with like computation and math. So if you think about what a neural network is, you're kind of dealing with an extension of regression, which is, you know, what's taught in a lot of different grad programs and undergrad stats and high school stats. And neural networks are basically kind of building on that. You have like some kind of weighted addition with a bias like regression. But what makes neural networks different is that there's a lot of flexibility to it. So we can model extremely complicated relationships between X's and Y's. For example, pixels and what an image is, whether it's a cat or a dog. So they're kind of called like universal function approximators. So if there's an underlying relationship between an X and Y, can we have just a very complex and abstract kind of machine adapt to this problem and figure it out? So that's kind of what neural networks are. And I feel like when you think about what AI is and kind of the news and things of that nature, we don't really go there, of course, because why would we? But that kind of like dispels the myth about it. It's not really kind of a magic thing. It's more grounded within computation. That being said, it is kind of sometimes difficult, depending on how complex your model is, to really understand what's going on. So like the term black box definitely applies in some cases. And if, you know, thinking about AI within IO psychology, that's sometimes potentially a little bit dangerous. For example, if you have an AI model that gets really good at predicting if someone is going to be good at their job, but you have no idea why, that can be troublesome. I'm not an assessment scientist, but if you have, you know, predictions that are like correlating with like different demographics and things of that nature, predicted groups, that becomes very troublesome if you can't really explain what's happening within that black box. It could be because, oh, they're wearing yellow shoes, so they must be good at their job. And we don't really know what the pattern is.
I believe at one point, I forget if it was Amazon, but it was one of the larger Seattle-based organizations tried doing something very similar. And the correlations came down to people named Jared and played lacrosse.
We're better at their jobs, or is that what they were predicting?
That's what the assessment decided was going to be a high performing candidate to hire for further work.
Wow,
it sounds extremely problematic. And yeah, I guess one.
In so many ways, and it's like, yeah, it introduces. Yeah, so there's like human bias, human like the whole human aspect of it. Is would be missing from it because we don't know what's inside of the black box, right? So let's say, you know, it can affect hiring decisions. Like, oh, okay, the AI says to hire this person, but like, well, why? Right? And we have to consider things of like that, who that person is as a whole, like diversity, like who would actually be a better fit. Where are we moving toward? And the algorithm may not know where it is that we're wanting to move toward and all of these things. So I think that's why a lot of people, that there's this cocktail of emotions around AI. There's like this excitement, there's this curiosity, but there's also this fear around AI as well, which I think is why it's important to dispel some of these myths, because I think it can ease the fear that like, number one, we're not yet talking about a robot, but even when we talk about robots, it's still underneath it. It's statistics, it's computation, it's math. But yes, there is this black box element. Can you think of another AI myth that we can perhaps dispel?
Another AI myth.
Well, Joe, why don't you speak to what the current state of the art actually is, because once the hype machine gets going, we lose track of things. So we've got, NLP things like you were talking about, digital assistants, which are NLP on top of a database. And then that goes off and does its thing. Then you've got the GPT-2, GPT-3, GPT-4, and that Llama and that ilk, Where are we on the scale of, say, zero to Jarvis?
Sorry, could you clarify what Jarvis is?
Jarvis is the AI assistant for Tony Stark in the Iron Man and Avengers movies that eventually becomes the Vision.
Okay, like a HAL equivalent or something. I think that's 2001: A Space Odyssey, like a
Or
all-knowing AI assistant.
Yeah, or say even the computer, the voice-commanded computer in the Star Trek series is across the board.
Yeah.
So, set anchor points for me and tell me where we are in between them.
Yeah, I think that's extremely hard to gauge. Kind of like Sam Altman put, like the CEO of OpenAI. We're kind of in this exponential, continuing exponential increase. I think that's basically how he put it. So if you zoom in on like an exponential increase, you're seeing rapid innovation, but then you zoom out and it just continues and continues and continues. So it's really hard to tell, I think, where we're going. And I guess I spend less time thinking about like what the future is, especially because it's so hard to predict. Especially within AI, especially. So if you think about like within my team, you're having innovations within the NLP community basically weekly at this point. If you compare that to a lot of IO psychology research, sometimes it could take, you know, 30 to 50 or 10 or a few years to kind of really question something that's really well understood and for that to change. And then you kind of tie that to the publication process, which takes a long time. It kind of disrupts innovation. But with AI currently, it's happening so fast. It's like, what's going to happen? So if it's like, hey, we should really use this model, it's the best, it's the state of the art right now. Literally the next day, the new state of the art can be released. And of course, there's a lot of nuance and complexity to what state of the art means, because some research may say, oh, well, ours is state of the art because of X, Y, and Z, but it's actually like a very minimal evaluation of the actual model. But basically what I'm saying is things are moving so quickly, it's really hard to tell what's happening. Of course, regulation is something that may, I guess you could say, impede progress or make the progress more helpful to many different groups of people. So I think that's kind of on the horizon. And of course, you know, there were people calling for like halts of research and halts for the release of models because we need regulation. So that's something that's definitely going to influence trajectory as well. But I think one of the big debates is like, are we going to reach AGI, like general intelligence? So this is like human level intelligence within an AI. And I think that's kind of like the Jarvis type model or something that we're talking about. Some people say 5 years, some people say 10, some people say whatever. There's a lot of debates on that. And it's possible that we're closer than expected to that. If you think about something like GPT-4 or Claude or Falcon or something like that, there's a lot of models out there right now that exhibit some of those qualities, but we're not exactly there yet. And of course, in this case, we're dealing with kind of still a simple notion of intelligence compared to humans. We're primarily dealing with text. GPT-4 can handle things like images. I think it's fairly multimodal. I forget exactly the modalities. But if you think about the comparing that to human intelligence, you know, we also obviously have multiple senses. And one of the big things too is that with humans, especially, you know, like considering where you are in your development, you can learn something extremely quickly. But with most AI models, it's like, no, we need to tell you what's correct like 1,000 or like 50,000 times before you like only understand this single task. So that's like a lot of models that I work with and a lot of people in NLP work with right now. So it's not really there yet. One interesting thing is that I think some research that I saw by Meta was like trying to combine most modalities of information that you can think of. So I think it involved things like maybe pressure and like sensing like heat or like kind of some kind of thermal thing. And then you have like vision, you have audio, and you also have text. So if you think about how kind of humans interact with the world, we're kind of consuming all of those modalities at the same time and mixing them and, you know, making decisions, something like that. So I think that's one like interesting line of research that when we look back at once we've arrived at AGI, maybe that's kind of like, you know, the beginning of it. I guess there's some other interesting work done by Yan LeCun, who I think is still at Meta, and I think he teaches at NYU. If you're not familiar with him, he's really big in the AI space. But what he's putting forth, and I haven't read the entire thing because it's just like, it's just beyond me. It's very, very deep and, you know, like so much math and things like that. Basically what he's putting forth is that we can have a collection-ish of neural networks that simulates the entire human brain. And he says it's differentiable. So what that means is that that's basically the way that neural networks learn. If it's differentiable, you can optimize, you can create a model that does something well. And he's combining, like, I think he kind of breaks down like, oh, this part of the human brain does this, this part does this. Also worldview is extremely important. So we need to integrate that as well. So it's kind of potentially another kind of seed of true AGI, of like a humanoid equivalent of a bunch of neural networks that learns. There's definitely a lot of interesting stuff going on with that. And I think one other thing that I'll mention is that a lot of the current state of some of like the computer vision models, so I don't know exactly how, of course, like a Tesla drives or something like that, where a lot of the language models, a big thing that they do that I mentioned before is this huge pre-training phase of just learning to predict the patterns within a massive amount of information. And there's benefits to that. But the issue is you're ultimately dealing with a model that just learns to predict what comes next, whether it's maybe within a picture or within language. And there's potentially something problematic about that, where you might see a plateau in capabilities if you just solely rely on that notion. It helps a lot, but in order to kind of reach the next echelon of AI capabilities, maybe there needs to be something different.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, go ahead, Rob.
Well, I want to take this and bring it back around to careers and dream careers. So sure. you're going the often as you're heading through master's to PhD, the question comes, are you going to go applied or are you going to go academic? And you're like, both. When you started off on this path, how much of that was part of your dream? How much of it was, I need to have my hands dirty in something that's actually producing something, and I need to have my head in a place where I'm continually being expanded?
Yeah. I guess I can kind of start with a kind of a funny story.
Please do. We love funny stories.
So when I was in grad school, I was in, I don't know what course it was, maybe philosophy, like philosophy of science or something like that, because, you know, hypothetically, if you're going to get a PhD, you should take one course in philosophy of science, right? I was in Stephen Toddy's class. He's a really interesting character. And he's like show of hands, and I think there were only three people in the class at the time, who wants to teach at some point? And I think we all raised our hands. And I was like, yeah, basically, you know, I'm curious about it. I would like to do at some point. I know that I'm not really a traditional academic, so I probably don't want to start in that. I'm not really interested in publishing much. But yeah, I would like to dip my toe in the water, as they say, and try it out. And so class ends. And then I think around 5 p.m. that day, I get a message and it's like, hey, you said you were interested in teaching. Do you want to start tomorrow? There's a class.
Nice.
And I was like, oh my God, like, this is insane. I don't know if I can do this. And I just started calling friends and family. I'm like, what do I do? What do I say about this? And I ended up just going for it. And hopefully none of my former students watch this. But like, I went into the class that morning with, and it was like a big auditorium. Like, I had never done this before. And it was just like really daunting. And like, in my head, I'm like, they don't know. I literally don't have the textbook for this course. I don't have a syllabus. I have like a syllabus from last quarter. I don't even know what this course is going to be about. I know it's intro psych, but that's of course like very diverse. That was kind of how I started teaching it.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
How's that compare, Jen, with your first forays into teaching?
Oh yeah. I was going to say like the first time I taught, it wasn't in an auditorium. It was in a lab. I did lab teaching. It was like an intro psych lab. So it was probably all of like 20 students in a computer lab. But I remember like I was shaking. I had the syllabus in my hand and I was like shaking like this. But then of course it gets easier every time you do it. Thank you, students. If any of you are listening, we're so understanding. Like they knew it was my first time. I was 100% transparent about that. And what's interesting about this is I've often thought of fear as the jagged edge of excitement, and that it's playing into that is how we reach our dreams, right? So what I hear you saying, and I can relate to it 100% because it's what I felt too, is there's this excitement, and then amidst that there's this fear. But even though you're scared, you do it anyway because you want it. And that really in there, that's like the formula for creating your dreams. It's like, you're scared, do it anyway if you want it. If you're scared and you don't want it, you don't have to do it, right? Like you don't have to like beat yourself up about it. But it's something that we're telling our clients all the time. It's like, do you want this? Yes. Are you scared? Yes. Do it. And it's really as simple as that, but often easier said than done because like, our brain gets in the way and, oh my God, I don't know. Like, oh, I'm going to talk to all my family and friends. What do they think I should do? All of that. We all do that. But it's just yet another example of, hey, I do want to do this. And wow, I clearly have no resistance to it because this opportunity just popped right in front of me in the form of a text. Hey, do you want to teach? Do you want to start tomorrow?
Yeah.
Sure. I guess I have to. That's really cool.
Yeah, awesome. I guess that kind of connects to like flow you mentioned before, like maybe there's like some kind of, and I'm going to butcher this, like Csikszentmihalyi stuff, like there's an ideal state of arousal. But kind of what you're saying is maybe just push yourself a little bit and go towards that hyper arousal. It might be a little bit uncomfortable, but that's where good things happen and growth happens, I guess.
Yeah, staying in flow. Mihai, Csikszentmihalyi, that's how I pronounce it. Don't ask me to spell it.
Yeah.
It's the godfather, the grandfather of flow research.
Yeah,
there's absolutely something to that at a psychological level. And where we like to go is, you know, even further than that, to a spiritual level. Like one of my favorite intersections is the intersection of science and spirituality. So when you add the spiritual component to, and so like things like mindfulness, things like meditation, things like being in flow are perfect examples of things where they're right at the intersection of science and psychology, and even neuroscience and spirituality. And so it's like really leaning into that. And for people who are open to it, I could talk about that all day long. So what you're talking about is like, okay, I was in flow psychologically, neuropsychologically in my brain. And there was also this element of me that was like, yeah, I'm going to do it. Like, I think this is what I was meant to do. Like, this is my purpose. So it's really cool to hear another example of that.
Yeah.
Awesome. So I want to kind of go back to the AI piece of it. And from where you sit, how do you feel about AI? Like if you had a crystal ball and you were able to look at it and sort of feel into the future of AI, like what emotions come up for you? What are your feelings around it?
Yeah. I would say one of the first ones, kind of what I mentioned before, is like, it's so hard to keep up. So it's kind of like, it makes your head spin. Like trying to keep up with research or models that come out. And I think, even working in it, I have a little bit of fear. Like even if, like hypothetically, the person that programs the AI or helps create good AI models, hypothetically, AI could do that. And I think that's already been proven to a large extent. Of course, there needs to be a lot of interaction and evaluations and auditing and things like that. But hypothetically, those could be automated as well. So I have a little bit of fear about that. Of course, I'm not saying like, you know, everyone is going to be automated. All jobs are going to be taken. We're going to have a universal basic income and we're going to eat protein pellets. And our only work is going to be feeding oil to the evil AI machine. I'm not necessarily saying that, but I think it kind of is going to
clearly they're influence. Going to be solar powered.
Yeah, that makes sense. Like, yeah, why even have that mechanistic process of feeding them oil or data? Yeah, might as well automate that as well. but yeah, I think that's something I think about some, but I try not to be too fearful. I try to be think about it sort of positively, like, well, if that were to happen, like, let's say that program is hypothetically eliminated, programming, maybe I'll just find something else. I don't know. That being said, of course, a lot of people say, like, oh, well, there's going to be a lot of jobs and things created by AI. You know, you think about something like DALL-E or different like generative models. Right now, they're definitely helping augment human intelligence, human creativity. You kind of think about, well, before we basically had the entirety of human knowledge within our hands with phones, before it was on the computer, before that within books, kind of inefficient, you know, to gather. But now with the current models, you're more or less able to get much quicker information. So if you think about like an internet search, yeah, it's great. Like you can find anything basically, but you have to filter sometimes for like hours. You're scrolling, you're looking at links and it's like, oh, this one's crap, I need to put it away. This one's really good, I like this. Now let me summarize it myself. But with something like GPT, you're able to basically get a more or less instant answer that's really understandable. It has bullet points, it has numbers and stuff like that. So I think that's been extremely helpful. But yeah, I think excitement, a little bit of fear, but with kind of a positive tint on that of, well, we can be adaptable. And it's more or less like another revolution. So probably comparable to something like the Industrial Revolution, but just something more technology oriented. So it'll be really interesting to see what happens. You know, of course it's cliche, but if you think about it, the Industrial Revolution has happened fairly recently in terms of a grand scale of things. And then you think about the internet in terms of grand scale of things, literally like not even yesterday, like a minute ago. So it's kind of daunting to think about where all of this is leading in terms of like the like 30,000 foot view of like human history and trajectory and human intelligence and our access to technology and stuff like that. So yeah, it's a little bit crazy.
So we're all about dreams and looking forward. Where do you want it to go?
Oh, that's a good question. Yeah, I would say good, just for overall good. But I guess the difficulty is like defining what good is. Like, you could say good is like, what if we can automate the roughest jobs in human existence? So if you think about like, I'm thinking about like the show, like Dirty Jobs, I think it was called on like Discovery mm-hmm. Channel, like someone that has to like dive into like a sewage tank and do something or whatever example you want to think of. It's just really tough. What if we can automate all of those things? But the issue is that's going to be offset by a lot of job loss and things of that nature. So I think it's a big question. It's kind of like the train scenario, I guess, which way do you want it to go?
Sure.
I would say one of the best directions is like, if you think about something like Neuralink, at least the vision that's being sold is like, well, what if we have a stroke patient or someone that, you know, like suffered seizures or someone that has difficulty communicating, they can only do sign language or things of that nature, like disabilities, or we have something like, you know, prosthetic limbs with some kind of intelligence. I think that's a great path. And that's definitely a path that's being taken right now. So I feel like that's definitely like overall net good for humanity, as opposed to other things. Like, if you kind of think about, companies like Palantir or something like that, where you also have on the other side of the coin, like basically AI generals that can make decisions. Like I think they reported on, like we essentially have like a chain of AI models or something that they like, we can assess how many enemies are here. We can then automatically determine how many drones we should send to that location. then we automatically determine like which targets to take out and things like that. That path maybe isn't as overall net good for humanity. But I don't know, I guess we don't really need to dive into that area, and I don't pay attention to that too much.
Wouldn't you rather play a game of chess?
Yeah. I do love chess though, if you ever want to play. Yeah. I'm decent.
I am not.
Yeah, I'm like, okay.
What about in the workplace? So that's kind of your focus right now, right? Working with Erudite. Where do you want to see like AI have a positive impact on the workplace and leadership and the work that people do and work environments, stuff like that?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you kind of think about the employee life cycle, I think there's a lot of different applications of AI. So if you think about something like recruitment, so trying to identify like pools of people that could be qualified and are diverse as well. I think AI and machine learning can definitely help out with that. For example, whether it's creating content to attract people, whether it's evaluating whether the content that's been produced has biased language, maybe it's going to produce an effect where a certain group of people are less likely to click on the job advertisement or something of that nature due to the language. I think there's a lot of help there. And then you have things like, well, when someone applies to the organization, resume screening. So I think this is a very difficult subject and it needs to be done very well because of the example that you mentioned before with, I think, Jared and lacrosse and things of that nature. And, yeah. You know, there's been, kind of like sensationalized news articles about different resume screening systems that have attempted to be implemented or just even evaluated and were kind of biased. So I think there's a lot to that. But at the same time, there's a lot of benefit because, I think there's a lot of stats thrown out there like, oh, the average recruiter puts, let's say, 15 to 30 seconds in each resume. And depending on how large that stack is, maybe it's larger or smaller. And then, you know, you, of course, have a lot of human biases ingrained in that. For example, what's this person's name? What is their assumed nationality based on that name? What kind of pedigree and prestige do they have based on their past education as opposed to like their actual accomplishments? You have all of those things. So AI is kind of potentially able to, whether it's make predictions based on that resume, or one thing that I've heard about is like matching. So you more or less can use an NLP model to look at someone's experience, their skills, and kind of match them to an opportunity, whether it's a job or a team where they're likely to fit in. And that could just be in the form of a recommendation. So like, here's five different roles that you should apply to, or five different teams that you could fit within, things of that nature. Another interesting application that I worked with a little bit with Modern Hire, who was acquired by HireVue, was something like automated job analysis-ish. So if you're familiar with job analysis, more or less, it's you're studying work, you're studying jobs and attempting to understand them either qualitatively or quantitatively. And then based on that information, you're going to create like a job profile or you're going to create an assessment because you want that assessment to tap into what the job actually is. You don't want the assessment to be like, oh, if you were a tree, like what kind of tree would you be? So that's another interesting example. For example, I know Hogan and there was one other company that was looking into it. I want to say Watson, but that's not it. The company that deals, or the Wunderlich, that does a lot of testing for intelligence with like the NFL and stuff like that. They were doing work where, hey, what if we gather like a massive amount of text about people talking about their job? Can we understand what they're talking about automatically? So if you think about like focus groups, automatically analyzing those to create an assessment or gather information about like organizational culture, things of that nature. So that's another good example. And I think there's a lot of different ones. And I guess to briefly mention, like once someone's within the organization, it could be analyzing survey data or like with Erudite, analyzing kind of like passively collected data and making predictions to better the workplace based on that. Or one other final example could be something like coaching. So maybe a coach kind of needs help with determining where to go with their client, or the person doing receiving the coaching kind of needs AI coaching. So you kind of have that on-demand coach, that in-the-pocket coach, where you can kind of reach out and say, hey, I'm experiencing X, Y, and Z at work. What's your recommendation? So that's where kind of like a GPT type technology can benefit in the workplace. I think there's a lot of examples, definitely a lot of interesting ones. And I guess, definitely a lot of work to be done, and especially like evaluating whether what the impact within the workplace is going to be. So, you know, doing the research to see, is it biased? Has it been trained well? Is it predictive, et cetera?
Yeah. And what about, let's dive into the employee engagement / making workplaces happier area. So again, just sort of leaning into the future, looking into the future, help me understand a little bit more how the AI and the natural language processing can do that. So my very flimsy mental model, based on what you've said right now, and based on my experience with this, is essentially that because you're able to collect massive amounts of data, and because you have the AI, the algorithm, able to look for patterns so quickly in a way that a human wouldn't be, it'll be able to give you data and give you some pattern matching information in a way that's much faster and perhaps much less biased and a lot of other better ways than a human might. So then you can take what the AI is giving you to then make decisions, for example, about what kind of training needs to happen, or what kind of like other kind of interventions, or what kind of fun things are needed in the workplace. Is that kind of basically the model that you guys are following?
Yeah. We can kind of ground it a little bit. So we can talk about like kind of like passive data, like communication channels, and also survey data. So with passive data, there's so much of it, right? You could potentially have millions of messages sent per day. And of course, if we wanted to read that and try to identify things about that, it's going to take probably multiple years. But if we're able to use AI to make predictions about that data and make sense out of it, then we're going to have that kind of instant-ish understanding of what's happening within the organization. So it's kind of like getting a really quick pulse on that information, and AI is able to help with that. With survey data, what you'll see a lot of times is just kind of like people call it either topic modeling or neural topic modeling or clustering or thematic analysis. So let's say we have 100 survey responses about the state of the vending machines within Office X. You know, what you're able to do and is basically just cluster that information. And then you end up finding like, hey, we have this group and they think the vending machine has a problem with the change aspect of it. And we also found this cluster, and these people think, you know, it's a little bit too expensive. And also the sentiment of this group is super low. And we also see that based on different filtering, that demographic Y especially has an important problem. And we know that demographic Y is extremely important to this organization. They drive outcomes, et cetera. So that's kind of like a practical viewpoint of it. Kind of like sorting a bunch of text into buckets and then quickly understanding those buckets so that you can make action on it. And then on top of that, you potentially have also automated recommended actions based on the information. That's kind of like the practical view of it.
Awesome. Yes. Awesome. So what I hear you saying is that there's also almost always, if not always at this point, a human on the other end of it, looking at the data. Here's what the AI is saying. Here's what the AI is recommending. And then there's a human, an expert, a subject matter expert, someone like that, who can then say, oh, okay, that might be a good idea. How do we then actually implement that? Or no, bad idea, computer. And I think if that's what's happening, that's what I hear you saying, that's also going to ease some concerns as well. That especially when we're talking about making massive organizational changes, it's not just like, okay, computer, just tell us what to do and we're going to follow it. And of course it makes sense logically, but I think just like when you drill it down to that level, it's like, yeah, we are still talking about data and we are still talking about data analysis, even though it's a huge paradigm shift in like probably the kind of data analysis I did when I was a grad student, right? Mm-hmm. Even so, and that's like 20 years ago, it's massive shifts that we're still using our human minds, our human intelligence to make decisions about what to do, who to hire, who to fire, what organizational changes to make.
Yeah, yeah. I think sometimes you'll see the human in the loop scenario, and I think that definitely eases concerns, especially from a user perspective. If I'm sure there's studies out there that show like, hey, if we tell you that a human is going to eventually evaluate this automated decision, maybe you're more likely to perceive this automated system in a positive manner. So a lot of times you're going to have subject matter expertise involved. For example, within Erudite, we have like an in-house team of expert psychologists, and they're able to be sure that everything we do is grounded within theory. Then some other cases, like I was reading an interesting paper by, I think it was with a team from NASA and maybe a couple of universities, that they also ended up creating an AI model based on subject matter expertise, which was really interesting. So they basically created a neural network architecture that kind of mirrors how an expert makes judgments. So they were looking at like identifying exoplanets, which I'm not exactly sure what those are. But I think it's like you have a main planet, then a secondary one or something like that. And
exoplanets are planets from outside of our solar system. We can only detect them when they pass in front of their star, and it obscures the light from that star. And then you have to wait for it to loop around again and happen again. So the way that they're doing a lot of the measurement of that is that they're taking millions and millions and millions of pictures, hopefully of the same star, looking for variances and pattern matching when those variances occur in order to identify that, yes, that is an exoplanet. Sorry, there was a Neil deGrasse Tyson on this like literally 2 days ago.
I knew deGrasse Tyson was going to play a role.
Yeah.
Awesome, awesome. Thank you for sharing that. I don't know too much about that stuff.
You need pattern matching for it.
So essentially what they, I think, and you would know better than me, but I think it's like, there's kind of like a library of past information, like Kepler or something. And it's like, hey, we have this library and we also have a bunch of data, like information about like our measurements of like our like instruments interaction with these potential exoplanets. And typically like maybe we look at it and try to determine that based on expert opinion. But what was interesting was they interviewed like these scientists and figured out like, hey, first they do this test, and now they look at like this waveform data, and based on what it looks like, they make these decisions, and they also consider this data source, et cetera. And what they did was that they kind of created an AI model to emulate those decisions. And what's interesting is it also makes it much more interpretable. So they could kind of more or less look within one of these networks or systems and say, oh, like this test passed because of this. Now we can have a human review that decision or something like that. Just kind of like a related tangent to human in the loop is helpful. Like subject matter expertise is always helpful, especially from like collecting data, but also like interpreting like predictions or being sure that the predictions are behaving like appropriately and like not in a biased manner.
Yeah. So I have one more question that's in the intersection of like IO psychology and psychology and AI, and then I want to turn it over to Rob. I want to hear what's bubbling up in there. So sure. I saw, I think it was on your website, I think it was the Erudite website, there was an article, I was just kind of browsing, and an article that caught my attention was around personality. And I believe it was something around AI being able to predict, or even NLP being able to predict people's personalities. Is this something that you're familiar with and that you can speak to? Because this is fascinating, right? Especially because like typically to assess someone's personality, it's like a battery of tests that can take hours, and then you have to go and analyze the data. But what I'm understanding from this is that we can based on someone's language patterns and potentially other kinds of nonverbal patterns too, we may be able to fairly accurately predict their personality. So can you speak to this at all?
Yeah, absolutely. So I've dove into this some. My dissertation's kind of is on this topic, and there's also a lot of research around it, mainly within computer science and kind of like computational psychology. So there's kind of like a huge research line out of I think it was UPenn and a university from Australia. I think, I want to say his name was Andrew Schwartz, was one of the main authors, but there was kind of a series of studies that looked at, hey, can we predict personality based on the way that someone speaks or interacts with the internet? One of their big things that they looked into was, one of them was, I think, likes on Facebook. So is there some kind of a coherent pattern to that where we can predict personality? Of course, like maybe like you, my Facebook likes are not representative of me because like they were like from 2011, like they're just super random. But they started looking into also like posts and stuff like that. So based on posts, can we predict self-reported personality? They ended up having, I think, a pretty large data set that at one point at least was openly released, where it was like, hey, here's like posts on Facebook or Twitter or whatever. And also here's self-reported personality. And you can train a model to make that prediction. So more or less within a lot of models, you just need X's and Y's, quality examples, and then you can train a model to predict that Y. So I think they found pretty good results with that. It wasn't perfect, but I've also seen work like coming out of computer science that can do it pretty well. If you think about like, what is personality? I'm probably going to butcher the definition because I don't read about it much anymore. But you have kind of like a consistent pattern to behaviors, right? And of course we have like, you know, like a neuroscientific or whatever influence to it, like genetic, but also like, how is it expressed? Well, we express it via the things that we wear, the background to our computers, maybe how we speak, our interests, et cetera. These are kind of manifestations of these things. So if there's kind of a coherent pattern between the way that we speak and the way that we interact with the world, hypothetically, AI can capture that signal and make predictions. One of the kind of what I was working with my dissertation, I'm still trying to finish it, but is there was a data set released in 2019 from a machine learning competition from the Society for IO Psychology, SIOP. And it was like, hey, can we train a model to predict personality based on the way that people type in this case? So I think they ended up having like, I would say like 1100 people or so, I think it was on MTurk, respond to different questions. And these questions were designed to elicit a certain personality. So if you think about the Big Five framework, like we have a question that is designed to elicit someone's agreeableness, like, how do you interact with someone when they're being mean to you? Do you tell them to buzz off, or are you like, oh no, it's okay, or except whatever, you know? So based on that, can we take the text and train a model to make predictions of their self-reported Big Five personality, which is a difficult task. And I know, I think there's some work in IO psychology that tries to do that right now. I think a lot of work by Lewis Hickman that I mentioned before looks at different populations, like I think job seekers and like college students, and kind of has them do like video interviews, ask them questions, and then also get that self-reported information, and then use that to predict models, predict someone's personality based on that model. So it's something that's possible. I think a lot of the work in the social sciences hasn't been able to do it too well yet. But what I've seen in computer science, they're able to do it pretty well. And then one other thing that I'll mention is, I think this was like a big competition in the ChaLearn data set. It was like, basically like, I think they called it the first impressions data set, like based on an X second clip, can we predict someone's personality? And I think they did that fairly well in that competition. So it's pretty interesting. And I guess you have like, kind of like I mentioned before, you also have the text, but some work will also use different types of AI models to also look at like facial movements and stuff like that. For example, someone that's more extroverted may be more likely to talk with their hands and stuff of that nature, or they may be more emotive with their face. So if there is a pattern there, like I've said before, maybe we can make predictions based on that. But of course, there's potentially a lot of bias to that source of information. There's a lot of danger to capitalizing on things like facial movements, especially from like a user perspective, but also like, is there truly meaning there, which I think has been called into question by some researchers.
Yeah, I would definitely break the model because I'm an introvert and my face moves all over the place. I often talk with my hands. I do not have a good poker face, let's just put it that way.
Yeah. It's like, alert,
it's fascinating. No. I think it's fascinating though. And I think that even like, it just has so many wonderful implications. There's potentially scary and nefarious ways that people can be using this kind of things. But focusing on the expansive ways and the fun ways and the useful ways, like even just like knowing someone's personality, you can get along with them better. We like, please understand me, right? Like the more that you understand someone else, the more that you're able to connect with them, whether it's in a romantic relationship, whether it's at work with friends or whatever it is. But then also things like who might be best fit for a particular position, at a job, that kind of thing. I think that being able to do that can help us connect on an even deeper level, on a human level, which is what we all crave for. And so being able to learn how to do that and having AI to help us along the way. And of course, always having the humans to say like, nope, actually, no, I'm an introvert. And you're wrong. is helpful as well. So
like with personality, I guess like introspection, can be difficult. And if you can kind of understand yourself better and kind of understand yourself from like someone else's perspective, maybe that helps, like you said, connect with other people or understand a role that you're like better for, stuff like that. So I think there's a lot of good use cases to something that seems a little bit creepy, I guess it takes getting used to. For like one random example, like if you think about diagnosing something like autism, like what if we can't even get someone into a clinician's office because like they're just too nervous or something like that? But what if we can just like have like a home recorded video and a couple assessments to make that prediction?
Yeah.
So yeah, just like a good example of kind of helping understand yourself a little bit more.
Sure. And sometimes even that diagnosis might be really empowering to someone. It's like, oh, okay, cool. I'm on the spectrum. Actually, like me, and I've talked to people like that, right? Where it's like, I have ADHD, or I have mild depressive disorder, or whatever it is. Wow, yeah, cool. That makes so much sense. Like, why couldn't the doctor tell me that? Why did it take years of therapy to figure that out? So it's it can be really empowering to be able to be like, okay, and if it feels empowering to attach that identity to yourself, then hey, that's great. I get to understand myself even more. And for many of us, particularly introverts, but I think extroverts too, that journey of knowing oneself is like the ultimate journey. And that's how we connect with others too. So
yeah, absolutely. I guess not diving into it too much, but I was at a talk, I think, when I was an undergrad, that kind of like said, like a lot of different diagnoses can be kind of like super abilities as opposed to disabilities. Like
you
can kind of empower you to understand it. And if you're a little bit neurodivergent, maybe you have different skills, but.
Absolutely. Yeah. I totally see them as superpowers.
Yes.
Awesome. I think we have a little bit more time. Rob, where do you want to go?
Well, there's a lot of things I would love to talk about with a pair of IO psychologists, one of whom is focusing on the more AI aspects of things, but I wonder how far afield do we want to go with this? Because some of the things you were talking about, all of the things that you're talking about at the end of the day come down to a statistical set of pattern matching. And then using that past behavior and that ability to detect that pattern in order to predict future things, whether that is the next bit of text, whether a pedestrian is going to run in front of your Tesla, or if so-and-so is going to be a good hire or is increasing their intent to quit. All of that is based on pattern matching of what's happened in the past. Knowing that you're being watched so we get a Hawthorne effect, I think, at some point, where people understand that at the workplace, their Slack messages, emails, vendor choices, et cetera, are being watched by this pattern matching stuff. How long before they adapt their behaviors in order to fake good, using the Wunderlich words for how they go through that stuff? and just naturally change or evolve their behavior to avoid whatever the detection is that they're trying to get around.
Yeah, I think, I guess I'll take a stab first, then I'm really interested to see what Jen says on that. I think one important thing is like messaging. So like understanding the use case and also communicating that use case, I feel like is really important in terms of perspectives and like positive perceptions of whatever technology is being used. And then you kind of also have, I've heard like the traffic, well, not the traffic light, but the speed limit effect. So at all times we could be being watched as like, how fast are you going? But like eventually you don't really pay attention to that because you're kind of always being watched. So if you think about like when you're using Google, some people are more concerned than others about like how their data is being used and things of that nature. So of course there's individual differences to it, but I think messaging is really important and kind of understanding like this is being used for good as opposed to like a more nefarious use case.
Yeah.
The individual differences bit is very interesting, especially when you're talking about behavior within an organization. But go ahead, Jen.
Yeah, yeah, 100% agree. And I was thinking the same thing, Joe, in terms of there's an adaptive effect. There's a habitual effect. I think especially if you're setting a powerful frame and you're setting expectations in a transparent way, and you're saying, actually, I know that in the beginning, like even if you explain some of the research around it, right? Like I know that in the beginning, it may feel like big brother or big sister is watching and that's cool. But really what we want over time is for you, you know that it's here and we've disclosed that it's here because we can't watch you without disclosing it. However, we actually want you to forget about it. It is kind of like a similar effect, like when you put a post-it note on your refrigerator and it's a new post-it note for the first, I don't know, week or so, it's like, okay, cool. Yay. This is awesome. This is a new thing. And then if you just leave that post-it note there, it just becomes part of the scenery. It's like, I've heard Andrew Huberman, neuroscientist at Stanford, talk about this effect as an actual neuro proven effect in neuroscience, that it literally just disappears into the background. So this AI watching could just disappear into the background. And I think letting people know about that. The other take that I would take on this is that, hey, cool. If they fake good, great. Isn't that the outcome? Right? Because first it's like, of course we don't want people faking it, but to a certain extent, revealing my beliefs here, I definitely believe in a just world. I definitely believe that we all want to do well. We all want to do good. It's just that often life gets in the way, being human gets in the way. So if something were to happen where someone were to fake good because they wanted to either gain the test or they wanted to get an A on this test that it's not even possible to get an A on, right? You know, like high achievers unite kind of thing. And then that just becomes their behavior. Then actually I'm cool with that, right? Like as long as they're not continuing feeling like they're faking, because you know, there's research on deep acting, surface acting. When it's surface acting, that can actually be really stressful. I'm faking good, that's actually leads to a high degree of stress. But when it's deep acting, in other words, it's integrated into my identity and this is just how I am. And I'm fully embraced this person who actually is 100%, you know, transparent and loving and courageous at work, cool. Then that's who they get to become. So it's an interesting question.
Let's zoom it out a level and let's look at something like applicant tracking systems. So now LinkedIn right now will tell you that for any opening that has been live for more than a week or so, it has thousands of applications. And it also suggests, like you were saying, LinkedIn also provides suggestion services for things that you might be a fit for. Right now, it's pretty terrible. Things are completely out of left field that it's suggesting you should be going for. Let's say, you know, to a certain extent, we understand that there's flaws in their algorithm, there's flaws in their modeling, and that it turns out changing your name to Jared and adding lacrosse to your likes gets you to an interview. someday everybody's going to be named Left Jared and play high school lacrosse.
Yeah, I see your point. I see your point. And it's an excellent one. It's an excellent one. That's ultimately not for good though. Right. So again, what I am using is a belief in a just world that everybody wants to do well, to be, you know, be good and do well for the good of all, you know, that kind of thing. That's not ultimately good for all, because that doesn't lead to diversity. That doesn't. Yeah. So that's still faking it, I would say. So, that's what I'm saying.
I guess a very weak counterpoint that probably has a lot of holes in it is, like, I feel like it'd be really difficult to be like, oh, this system really capitalizes on Jareds that play lacrosse. Like, how could you really identify that, you know? But I see I see your point though.
Yeah.
And we do live in a world of, and applicant tracking systems are a bugbear for Jen and I. We help people to achieve dream careers, and their dream careers are often stymied by applicant tracking systems that just reject things outright. And a lot of that would actually benefit substantially from deeper learning models that understand all of the different ways that expertise can be expressed. And right now, I don't think many of them are there. Yeah. Right now, I think we're still at a very high level keyword level. And it's very frustrating for, you know, that person who puts in the 2478th resume on the pile, that's never getting looked at by a human.
Yeah. And that's why we coach our clients, like, don't let a robot make decisions, talk to humans, right? So we don't even have to, like, our whole system of coaching clients to land their dream careers is no robots, right? Because until we can have more confidence in the validity of applicant tracking systems and the reliability of it, as career coaches, we're going to be like, yeah, do everything that you can to avoid it. Yeah, write a resume. That's an important part of the process. And I think, but the main part of the process is the human interaction piece of it. But I think that there's huge, like, yeah, people complain about it. Okay, great. That means there's a huge opportunity. There's a huge problem with applicant tracking systems. That means there's a huge opportunity in order to do them well, to do them better, because we've had clients, and most of our clients are higher level technical leaders who are amazing and have great resumes, right? Even just out the gate of what they show us, like, we help them upgrade them and make them extraordinary, but their resumes are great. They have a fabulous background. They're fabulous communicators. And yet the applicant tracking system just keeps rejecting them. So our process is, okay, just take the applicant tracking system out of the equation here, because you're amazing. And they just get filled with shame and frustration, and maybe I'm not good enough. And it's like, no, that's not true. And we're really proud and we're really honored to be those people. But again, to anyone who's working on AI and applicant tracking systems, I don't know if that's something you guys are working on at Erudite, but there's a huge opportunity here to make it more, for lack of a better term, human, so that we're not just rejecting people outright that are very, very qualified and doing wonderful at the job.
Yeah, I guess there's something to be said about, like, just reaching out and creating a network in terms of being able to make connections that would help you, like, gain that role, as opposed to just throwing your name into a pile, kind of similar to, like, you know, like before, like, just walking along your street in your hometown and being like, hey, here's my resume. It's great to meet you. Let me shake your hand and meet you. That's becoming more difficult, but you're still able to kind of, like, network and things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Or you can just kind of, you know, take a bunch of white text and put in your resume and with all the keywords and beat the system, I guess.
Gosh, yeah.
But it only beats people the system that for, like, a fraction of a minute before somebody's like, oh yeah, we need to ignore any time that it says this, that, or the other thing, or doesn't have these aspects of it. It's we're at SEO, but, you know, search engine optimization throughout the early aughts was a bunch of keyword stuffing. And people are trying to treat the resumes the same way in order to get around these things, missing out on the kinds of conversations that just kind of happened for you to get you into your dream role.
Yeah. So I thought it would be fun. Let me know if you want to play this game, Joe. We can wrap this up with a fun chat GPT hacks. One of the fun things that I have been noticing a lot lately, whether it's on Facebook or even our clients or even us just playing with it or us playing with ChatGPT with our son, is like, ooh, what can we ask it and what can we have it do? Right. So One of the things, for example, some of the hacks that we're playing with is, and I'll be 100% transparent about this, is figuring out a way to help with our marketing. Right. Mm-hmm. What we would never do, People Stack Nation, is have ChatGPT write something and then just copy paste it and put it out there because it's terrible. But it's like for ideas, for new things that we might not have thought of, like that's a cool thing. And when I was having a conversation with clients one time, and I don't remember what the topic was. Oh, actually, I think we were talking about the book Atomic Habits. And somebody was like, oh, I haven't read that book. What's it about? And here I am like, oh, okay, I could link to the Amazon thing. And a client who was on the Zoom call, he asked ChatGPT, please summarize the book Atomic Habits for me and just copy pasted it into the Zoom chat. Oh, thanks. There you go. I think it was super useful in the moment. So then we had a fun conversation. So what are some of your favorite ChatGPT, or just if you want to zoom out to any kind of AI that might be freely available, hacks to make life more fun, more useful, whether it's in business or for pleasure or anywhere else?
Yeah. One interesting thing is I've heard about, I think with like the DALL-E model that creates like paintings, I think, is that if you like prime the model to kind of hype it up a little bit, like, hey, you're an expert in this field. There could be a little bit difference in its behavior as opposed to just like no prompt regarding that. Also, I found that pretty interesting. One cool technology that's been coming out, and I don't know too much about it at this point, is something like LangChain. I think Llama Index is related to that, but it's a little bit different. But it's essentially like there's different texts that are like combining a bunch of different things. And that's kind of creating the roadmap of being able to like automate a bunch of different processes. Like you just give it like one initial prompt and then it senses, oh, I need to consult X, Y, and Z tools or sources or something like that. And I could be simplifying it or a little bit wrong in this case, but you end up having like kind of like an automated worker for you in some cases, like an automated assistant. For example, you hypothetically could use like GPT and similar technologies to like look through emails and just respond for you or just get a very quick review automatically and then send it there. So I think that's one interesting thing. But overall, I feel like with GPT, you kind of have to experiment a little bit in terms of how you interact with it and prompt it. For example, like getting a little nerdy, but like it's kind of like a prompt tuning exercise. Like, let's say you want to create really good recipes and you somehow understand what a good recipe is. Well, let's just kind of apply like an experimentation mindset to it and try 5 different prompts and clearly plan the manipulations for each of the prompts and just see which one does better. So like, you know, an everyday case, just kind of try it out and see what works well. But yeah, I think the expertise one is a pretty interesting example of kind of how to hack it. I've come across someone that kind of hacked GPT a little bit to like be an educator. And it was really cool because the user could kind of be like, hey, there's like a bunch of different settings to it. Like, I want to learn about airplanes or something, but I want it to be at like an 8th grade or novice level. And I want my teacher to be really understanding, or I actually want the teacher to be like really mean or something like that. And like, you can customize all these things and kind of have that educator at your fingertips. I think that's definitely really interesting. And I guess one final interesting GPT thing that I'll mention was, I've heard of people like actually having like basically multiple large language models interact with each other. So you could have like 2 GPTs debating something that you want to decide, and based on your prompt, one produces a response, and then it's like, okay, actually that response now becomes the input to the other GPT model, and they kind of duke it out, whether it's like philosophy or like, you know, trying to decide where you want to travel or something like that. That's potentially helpful just like in terms of like getting to a good outcome. And kind of from like a nerdy perspective too, it could kind of be sure that GPT's recommendation or whatever prediction is more based in reality and information if you're able to provide it like additional sources as well. So yeah, I guess that also is one helpful thing. Like if you're able to provide GPT grounded information, that's going to be helpful for it. One thing that people talk about is like hallucination with large language models, because sometimes their predictions are bad because they're more or less trying to predict what happens next in the sequence. But if you're able to be like, hey, here's an internet source and this internet source has this information, and then giving that within the prompt, it could give you a higher quality response. So that's something practical as well.
So you feed it information. You say, hey, based on this and this massive or even not so massive information that I have that I know is true, please help me create something else new.
Yeah, so that's potentially going to help it like produce more truthful information.
That's awesome. It's a great reminder that it's not a human, it's not a robot, as you said, that it does take some experimentation, and it could be some kind of experimentation. Cool. Rob, any final thoughts or questions before we wrap up? You're muted.
I'm excited to see where it goes. I do want to have a intelligent digital personal assistant. I don't need a robot following me around, but like the Star Trek computer in a room of my house asking for something and having it happen. And I was hoping that the AI or the digital assistants from Google and Facebook and Meta rather, and all of the things would get us there. They really didn't. And
it can make a grocery list.
Sort of.
We've all
but
had
yeah, I am looking forward to a future where I have that kind of assistant. I am looking forward to when we can trust some of these models. Right now, the number of hallucinations, the inability to provide a factual knowledge base and say these are the facts, and the inability to really structure that makes me a little reluctant to engage with the GPTs and the llamas and the Claudes and all of that. But I'm looking forward to them having discrete capabilities and it being more seamless. So yeah, please keep on keeping on and bring those higher order levels of statistics and modeling into it so that they can get even better. Yeah. How? Yeah. I just want to know, like, when am I going to be able to install an AI core in the house and have it just be like,
yeah, come
run
on.
The thing.
Can't you tell us that, Joe?
Come on, Joe.
Yeah,
come on.
I don't need it, but I'll if I know, I'll let you know, and we can both have assistance.
Cool. That's awesome. Well, yeah, we're in the middle of a huge inflection shift now. Said around how things are just shifting so quickly. It's almost dizzying. With why it's hard to predict the future, but it's exciting at the same time. It's like, I feel like inflection shift isn't even the proper word. It's like a mega, you know, it's not just a herd, it's a mega herd. You know what I mean? Like it's a mega inflection shift upon like day after day and second after second. Yeah. And it's so exciting to have and informative and useful to have conversations with people like you. So. Thanks for
thanks for having
today.
Me. Yeah.
Awesome. So if people want to find out about Erudite or follow some of the things that you guys are up to, what would be the best way for people to do that?
Yeah, I think you could probably search just Erudite, E-R-U-D-I-T, probably AI and people analytics. And it should come up and you can kind of find out about more of what we do.
Awesome. That's great. Yeah. All right. Well, again, thanks so much, Joe, for taking the time today. It's really fun.
Yeah.
Really useful conversation.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Let's keep in touch. And that wraps up another episode of the PeopleStack podcast. Thanks for listening and for supporting our mission. We are all helping to positively transform the tech world, one tech leader at a time. I have so much gratitude for all of you, for our badass clients, our loyal listeners, every one of you who we've worked with. And I have to give a special shout out to my husband, Rob Allen. He's my co-CEO, the love of my life, PeopleStack Client Zero. And it is such a fun ride, finding new, ridiculously unreasonable levels of prosperity, joy, and fun with him every single day. And a quick thank you to Ketza for creating the catchy, inspiring theme music that we get to use in our podcast. We love each and every one of you. Big, big hugs, aloha, and mahalo.